Three, two, one, good morning.
Good morning.
It is still morning. I talked about this yesterday. I always say good morning, and then I realize it's two. So how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
You want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Jim Bremmer. I'm a physicist. I'm retired now, but still consulting a little bit on the project I was working on before.
Can I tell you I'm the first physicist that I've met? And that's been on my podcast. So thank you. That is really, that's quite a title. What is it? I mean, can you talk a little bit about, because I'll just say, I started doing a podcast to chat with people and to try to become a little smarter with each person. I feel like this is, I love science. I love this kind of stuff. So I'm just going to listen and, you know, I'm going to chat with you, but I'm just very interested.
Okay. I'm working basically on a weather satellite called GOES. They've just put up a new generation, the 16th and 17th in the series. They started back in the early 70s. These are geosynchronous. They are 22,000 miles high, and because of that, they're stationary. They rotate around the same speed as the Earth rotates, so they have a constant view.
So I was watching a thing last night about the world, you know, how the world was created and the galaxies. And they were saying that the higher you are away from Earth, the faster time goes. So do you, is time in these satellites that you're working on 22,000 miles up different?
It may be, but it's an extremely small effect.
But so, do you have to, like, does that have to be written into a program to adjust for that?
For GPS and things like that, which really try to time things down to, you know, sub-nanoseconds and so on, yeah.
Well, and
No, I don't think so.
And I'm not testing you. I just happened to watch this great thing on Netflix or on YouTube about how the galaxy works. And I was amazed. They used an example of, like, three stories. The people on the ground floor, they move a little slower than the people on the third floor. It's not obvious, but, you know, space-time, time and space, that how it works with gravity and all that stuff, and I'm not very smart about that, but I was amazed that, you know, time changes the higher we are away from the source that bends time, space-time. But, sorry.
Yeah, that's a general relativistic effect. At the for this kind of thing, I don't think it's very relevant.
Not relevant. Okay, cool. So you're working on weather satellites.
Yeah. They started a couple of years ago to launch a new generation. This one has 16 channels, both visible and infrared, most in the infrared. And they do things like measure water vapor, there are some channels that get down to the measuring the Earth's surface temperature when there are no clouds or other obstructions in the way. Other ones measure water vapor and CO2 at different heights, so they really get a profile of the Earth's atmosphere. And then the main advantage is that they can track from geosynchronous altitude. You can see almost an entire hemisphere. So there are two of these things. One is at about 75 degrees west longitude, which is just about where we are here, within a degree. And the other one's out in the Pacific Ocean, 137. And then the Japanese and the Europeans and Indians and so on, Chinese, have other satellites. So they basically get almost global coverage. These are all at a band around the equator, so they don't see the North and South Pole, but they see within a few degrees, 8.5 degrees of that.
So what are we trying to achieve with weather now? I mean, obviously, we want to be warned if we have a storm or something, you know, if danger is coming, but do we want to predict weather? Do we want...
Well, it's a combination of things. Weather is the main driver for this, that you have the ability to track severe storms over open ocean and stuff like that, which is something that you know, didn't exist 50 years ago.
Right.
It used to be that, you know, they'd get messages from sailors and stuff like that, that there's high seas out there and storm, but they people really didn't have the data to predict and to track storms, and now we do.
What's the saying? Red skies in morning, sailors take warning. Red skies at night, sailors delight. You know, but there's some truth to it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure about that particular thing, but, you know, the ability to...
But kind of going back to what you said, there was a time we didn't have data. We had to,
right.
You know, and you brought up the sailors. I mean, that's, you know, that's just something that, you know, the old wives' tale or something,
right.
You know, like it, but there was some truth to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, now we have both the satellites and Doppler radar, so...
Right. That, yeah, then we don't have to... No more wives' tales now. We
right,
got all the data.
But, you know, there's still things like tornadoes that happen very rapidly and so on. And the main advantage of geosynchronous altitude is that you can, as I said, see almost the entire hemisphere. And so it's possible to track these storms. They have the ability now on this new generation to take a picture every 30 seconds of a small segment. Well, not small, but say, you know, like 600 by 600 miles or something like that, and take one every 30 seconds. So you can see what the storms are doing. There's also a thing called the lightning mapper, which detects... Lightning detects a narrow spectral line that's only excited at, you know, 15,000 degrees or something like that,
right.
when lightning strikes. So,
well, we just went through that big storm that came across that was kind of stuck mm-hmm. down in Texas for a week, and all the flooding. But you know, you watched, you know, and I used to be really into weather when I was working on a golf course. That was mm-hmm. you know, I lived by the weather. In fact, I was a little. It was a little depressing because, especially when you're, you know, trying to grow bentgrass in this region, you would look at the weather and they would tell you that it was going to be 98 degrees for the next 7 days. So I knew that my week was screwed. So,
yeah.
But when that storm was coming, that low pressure was coming across the United States. I mean, they showed, what was it, 50 tornadoes? I mean, and it's just the lightning strikes. You're like, oh my God! It's like. When you put it all out there, you're like, wow, I'm surprised we're even alive.
Yeah. Well, we're hopefully getting better at warnings. Still, I think there were fatalities for people who didn't have enough time to.
Well, and there's always cover, that. I mean, I know if there was a tornado here and I got the warning, which I have gotten, I would probably go outside and I would look and see what's going on instead of. Well, and that's funny because we just had, and you guys probably got the alert.
Yes, we did.
I slept through it.
Mm hmm.
He slept there too. So Jim's wife is here, Mary, who is a friend of mine. So she wanted to sit in. So if that's who's also talking, she's hanging with us. And you know, Mary, I'm watching, and you're very proud of Jim. I was telling you, I like that. He's staring. She's proud of you, Jim.
Okay.
So the weather. I mean, what is there? And it's kind of recent. You probably know about it, but there's a company that's sending out these little. Like almost like a loaf of bread satellites.
Yeah, they're things called CubeSats. They were originally designed to enable students and so on to launch something into space. As you probably can know, it's very expensive to launch a satellite.
A 70s style satellite.
Yeah, even and these. They have standardized components that can be put together, and then people will put a unique sensor in if they... And so they're launched as secondary payloads when the rocket that's launching a major satellite has excess capacity, then these so-called CubeSats can be put on, and they're after the major satellite is deployed, then they... put some of these others into orbit. So that is it's a major breakthrough because it's a very economical access to space. And although these satellites are small and somewhat limited in what they can do, there are things that are done, like people will deploy big antennas from very thin metallic surfaces.
Well, and I had I have another client that is, he works for, I forget the company, but they build satellites, and he's retiring. He's like, satellite business is different now. Now I'm sure, like what you're doing, that I don't know exactly what he was doing, but you know, these little smaller satellites, they're doing things for cheaper. They're doing, you know, doing more with less. These small companies, especially like, you know, NASA is a great example. You take like an Elon Musk or a Jeff Bezos company where they, you know, and if I'm wrong with the numbers, forgive me, but something like $2 billion to build a rocket, launch it and land it, where it takes, you know, NASA or the United States a lot more money, much more money, because we spread the work out through different states and different things like that. But that's, I mean, I can imagine that would be challenging if you're like a government building satellites and then you have these other private companies that are building it for a lot cheaper.
Yeah, well, I've worked for government contractors funded by NASA and by NOAA. And again, we have a situation where NOAA goes to NASA to procure the satellite and the instruments, launch them, check them out on orbit, and then NOAA operates them on a routine basis. NOAA's expertise is in handling the data and, you know, reducing the raw data, the ones and zeros, into weather predictions.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I can't remember the name of the company that's launching these, but they're taking, you know, whether it's a 600 by 600 or 60 by 60 picture of the ground every day, the same spot. I mean, they're posting pictures where one day a tree has snow, the next day it's melted. I mean, it's hard to hide anything now in the United States. You remember like Area 51 or these secret spaces that right. No one knew about. Now they just fly the, I mean, you can look at Area 51, I think, on Google Earth. I don't think I've done it. But I bet it's there if you really wanted to see. It's hard to have secrets these days.
Yeah, I know that they. I think they can take resolution as small as, I think, 18 inches or something like that,
yeah.
Half a meter. And below that is classified. But, you know, you could. I've heard, you know, spy satellites can read license plates and stuff like that. That's not in the public domain, but they're certainly able to see very fine features, you know.
Technology is just really...
I know. Right, it has really gone.
You're an older fellow. I mean, did you think you would see this kind of thing in your lifetime, this kind of technology?
I don't think I thought it would go that rapidly. I guess there's some people like Moore's Law. He claimed every 18 months, you know, computer technology would double in its capability. And
that sounds like the life of a new
right,
iPhone.
Yeah, so that, you know, it really has gone phenomenally, more than I would have expected, yeah.
Well, and, you know, and as a kid, you know, and remember the Dick Tracy watch, you know?
We have our... two-way wrist radio, and it's also a, you know, a cell phone, an internet, GPS, calculator, stopwatch, you know, you name it.
As a kid, you're like, oh, my God, how awesome would that be? You could talk or, you know, you
right,
get in your
I
car
know.
And it tells you how to get there. But, and you know, your generation knew privacy.
That's true.
Bled it privacy. You know, it was like my father, you know, privacy. My generation, I knew what privacy was, but I'm also in the where the privacy is starting to go away. And then my kids, they won't know privacy.
No.
They won't
true.
Know privacy. But we love to, you know, especially my dad's generation, they love to, you know, complain about privacy. But, you know, like when you get in your car, when I get in my car, it says, 9 minutes to the salon, traffic is low. And I'm like, well, I like that. I appreciate that. But that's because someone knows where I'm at and someone's tracking all this other junk. Taking away my privacy, so I'm trying to figure out, you know, do I like convenience? I do. And do I, you know, am I upset that I'm losing privacy, which I'm not really, I didn't really care about.
No, I worry about that too. You know, some people assume it will all be used for benign purposes or at least not, you know, bad purposes, but well, Mary's reading 1984 right now, rereading it. I remember reading it when I was young, and you know, a lot of the stuff is there. There's security cameras everywhere with facial recognition software. The GPS can track you if you, you're using your cell phone and so on.
We were watching, I think it was like Live PD or something last night, and there was a guy that was, or a police officer with a car that had automatic license plate readers. Mm-hmm. So he just drove, and this would just read, scan license plate as they passed.
Yeah.
And then if he hit one, bing, they would say, you need to pull that guy over for whatever the warrant or whatever it was. But, you know, that stuff's going on now. And I watched the thing on 60 Minutes about these facial recognition, and they say that China is, like, ahead of everybody in this AI. But, you know, this camera's constantly, like, focused on the class, and then over each kid it would be, like, happy, neutral, sad, focused, paying attention, you know. And if the kid constantly was, like, turning and not paying attention, they would take that information and they would say, okay, this is a child that maybe we need to give a little more attention to. So as weird as that is, but, I mean, that's almost, it seems like it's beneficial.
Yeah, a lot of the uses are beneficial, but, of course, in the wrong hands. This,
well, right.
Like in China, they use it to track dissidents and stuff like that. And the,
what's a dissident?
Yeah, somebody who does something that the government doesn't like, whatever government is there. You know?
So someone against the government is a dissident.
Yeah, that's the trouble. It's a very, the definition of a dissident depends on
who's saying it.
And, you know, a lot of the things are done that, you know, people do things like they'll send a tweet or something like that when they're angry and 10
like
years later it can come back to bite you, you know.
Yeah. Well, and I'm assuming we've had to, I mean, I'm not into like the CIA and stuff, but I'm assuming that we have a lot of dissidents, you know,
yeah,
with
sure. public,
with Twitter and, you know, social media, you know, everyone's got a gripe. And, you know, maybe 50 years ago, maybe they would have paid more attention to every person that had a gripe, but geez, now it seems like everybody's got a gripe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they talk about being patriotic. You know, I think as the definition for someone that was patriotic before is, I'm not sure if it's the same now. You know, people want to pick out things that people do and they want to call them not being patriotic.
Yeah, I know. Or so.
But what about like if you don't take care of yourself? You know, like if we're not taking care of ourselves and then our insurance is changing and our health care, but, you know, but we don't pay attention. That's not patriotic, you know. That's not considered
health of the country.
I
remember reading somewhere that a Chinese woman said that she had a Fitbit, and if she didn't take a certain number of steps a day, that she would be charged more for insurance. And there are things like...
Really?
Yeah.
In America?
No, I think this was in China.
Because I think that's a good idea.
Well, okay.
At some point, do you think we should start being held accountable for our health?
Well, I can see the misuse of this kind of thing. That's, again, 1984. Everybody had to do exercises in front of a TV camera, you know. And
oh, really?
Yeah.
I might have to read that. That's interesting.
And, you know, it's a few years after that, but basically it's the same thing. And it's... you know, again, this power, if people know what you're doing, it can be abused. It can, you know, there's the assumption that everyone who uses this information is just concerned about your health.
Well, no, but believe me, if there's dollar to be made, somebody's going to get into it.
Uh-huh.
No, but I'm just saying, like, I mean... Healthcare is a great example. I feel like I don't know where it's going to end up. You know, I don't, you know, you got one side, you just want to be nice, you know, oh, poor thing. But then the other side's like, you know, we can't afford healthcare because of where it's gotten through, you know, hospitals and doctors and all this stuff. And then at some point, you know, I know that now that you can buy or Progressive, I think, offers a thing you can stick in your car where they monitor your car. And if you're a good driver, they see it, so they give you a better rate on insurance.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, and you're right, it could be abused, but at some, I just feel like maybe for my kids or even my kids' kids, at some point, something's got to give, right? We can't, I mean, healthcare is just going to become so expensive. And like for me, I have healthcare, I pay for it for all my kids, only if we got hit by a car, when we use it, you know, unless, you know, of course we had to go to see a doctor, but even the deductible is so high, you don't even reach it. So you pay it anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I didn't have you on the podcast to talk about health insurance. So like I wanted the more physicist side, but it is interesting. And, you know, electronics and I guess the technology, it just gets in everything, right?
Yeah. It
eventually we have satellites tracking.
As, people say, like, somebody came to service our heating and air conditioning system, and he says there's almost as many computers in that as there are in your cell phone and microprocessors. And I guess the automobile industry is actually the biggest user of microprocessors, uses more than the computer industry. So they're everywhere, and cameras are extremely cheap now, and so on. But
Tesla. I want a Tesla. I want an electric car. But now I watched a video about these people that have charging anxiety. I guess this is now going to be a condition. Yeah. But you know, you worry, and I'm afraid I would have that. Like I don't have gas anxiety because I can get gas anywhere, but. Electricity, you know, you don't have all the, there's, you know, Wawa's providing places to charge your cars, right, but, you know, I would be like, God, do you think we can make it?
Yeah, well, that's it. If you worked in an urban area, particularly where you had a lot of stop driving, and say you didn't go more than 50 miles or 100 miles a day, and you had your own recharger at your home, then be a great thing to have. But most people want general purpose cars where they can take a road trip and not worry about charging. And even if charging stations are there, you know, it takes maybe 5 minutes to gas up your car and takes hours to recharge an electric car. So, you know, hybrids probably are a good general purpose car, but all electric, I don't think most people will buy them, maybe as a second car, but not as their own primary means of transportation.
That's a good point. Maybe as a second car. I know that, and then I was also worried, you know, so if I fill up my car with electricity, is that last 20% as good as the first 90?
I don't know.
Is it weak? Does it change? Does it affect my
Does
car?
Does the voltage go down? Yeah. I'm not sure. I don't know enough about that. But again, people need to look at, you know, we say we're going to reduce carbon emissions by having electric cars. Well, that depends. If the electricity is generated by coal, right. I'll almost guarantee
clean
you.
Clean coal?
Yeah, I think that's an oxymoron.
It is.
You know, you're probably using more carbon dioxide for passenger miles, certainly on highway driving. And, you know, there are transmission losses, you know, you have to have transmission lines, then you have to charge your battery, and then the battery has to run the motor, and none of these things are 100% efficient. They're highly efficient, but so you really need to look at the entire system, not to mention the fact that, you know, we talk about using solar cells and things, and the process of making them can be fairly dirty.
Right. So well, there's a lot of,
So I think people tend to react, you know, again, in Orwell, like the, you know, like the sheep in Animal Farm, yeah, green energy, good, you know, fossil fuels, bad.
Yeah.
And again, you need a mixture if you either need nuclear power or some kind of fossil fuel for a base load because, you know, both solar and wind are intermittent sources. So.
Yeah. Well, and I'm always amazed at these big wind farms that they have out there in the Midwest that just huge. mm-hmm. or the big solar farms. I mean, I think Elon Musk ideally wants to have a giant solar farm that supplies all the electricity, all the energy towards the cars. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if that's ever possible, but, you know, someone was saying that you can actually, I'm not sure if you can do it now, but it has the capability of where you can be somewhere and say, hey, come here, car, and your car will drive to you mm-hmm. and get here just fine. I was watching a thing where maybe it was 6 months ago, there was a guy that was filmed sleeping in a Tesla driving down the highway in California, not passed out, but nodded off.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, people are falling asleep in this electric car. And he goes, and Elon said, well, people fall asleep in cars all the time, and they've always have been. The difference between what my car and your car does is my car will quietly pull you over to the side and then start honking to wake you up, where yours will put you into a tree. Mm-hmm. And the guy's like, oh, good point. You know, another guy was saying that these Teslas are so smart. They're just, you know, they're hard to crash. They're hard to get in an accident in. You know, they're just constantly, you know, with cameras and the technology. Mm-hmm. I don't know how we can all want that. I mean, it'd be kind of cool if you could have that same technology, but with maybe a hybrid or a gas car. Mm-hmm. That would be, and satellites to track them. So how does it, are you working on one satellite? So you're working on, no, it's two satellites, right?
These two, yeah, the same, they're, you know, the same series. They're called GOES, which is Geostationary Operational Environmental Satellite. They're weather, and they also do long-term trending, like, of climate and stuff like that, measuring ocean surface temperature and things of that sort.
So Mary said you were working on an equation for a laser. Is that how you determine a cloud or through lasering it, shooting a laser through it and what it brings back, the density and stuff?
Now, this is what they call image navigation, change taking the image off a focal plane on this camera that's 22,000 miles up and registering it to the point of it on the ground. Because it's so far away, a small tilt will cause a big error in your position on the ground if you don't.
Right.
And you want to know where the lightning is for warnings, particularly of things like flash floods. Is it in this valley or is it the next valley over and so forth, where there's a lot of lightning, because cloud-to-cloud lightning is a precursor to a lot of very severe weather. So this gives people warnings. Now, what I'm doing is we have a couple lasers, one in Greenbelt, Maryland, the other one in Monument Peak, California, which is a little east of San Diego. And they shoot this laser up at the satellite in the narrow spectral band that it has. And so this is done occasionally to make sure we know where it's pointing. It can see coastlines during the daytime, but only within a couple hours of
noon. Like a calibration, sort of?
Yeah, it's calibration, exactly. Calibrating the positions. So that's what I was working on when I retired, and I'm continuing to, you know,
When I lived in San Diego, because I actually lived there, Sereno Valley, there was a bank there that every night you would drive and you would see a laser shooting into the sky.
Yeah.
And I guess it was sending bank data up to a satellite or mm-hmm. some sort, but I had never seen that. I'd never seen that up until then, and I have never seen that since. I've never seen a laser shoot into the sky like it did in the bank in San Diego. Is that something that happens a lot, or was that unique?
Well, they do it. The main thing where they use lasers is they have satellites in low Earth orbit that are basically cannonballs with retroreflectors on them. That means, they have something that'll shoot light back in the direction.
Like a mirror or something like that?
Yeah, basically. But wherever you, very often there are three mirrors that are all perpendicular to each other, and so the light comes back, regardless of what angle you hit it at. If it hits all three mirrors, it comes back at the same in the opposite direction from where it was going.
And that's because the Earth is round.
Well, this is because, well,
Well, because I said, you know, there's these people. There was a guy on my podcast who's a flat earther, and he thinks the earth is flat. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, if it was flat, we could just shoot, you know, right over to across the flat earth to another. But the fact is that, you know, it falls away because of the roundness of the earth.
Yeah, it would be hard to have orbiting satellites on a flat earth. Yeah, I agree with your point.
Wouldn't that be funny? I mean, it's like that's – I go, but I just saw a movie where there's a show on Netflix called One Strange Rock. If you ever get a chance, if you have Netflix to watch it, it's really interesting. But I go, because it's basically talking about how the Earth was created, you know, from the very beginning. But it's kind of in the perspective from 11 different astronauts that have, you know, spent up to 1,000 days cumulative, the group, on the space station.
Yeah.
And the one guy was like... you'd be very interested to see how much activity goes on above our, you know, our atmosphere, how much stuff gets burned up, all the little rocks and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Because you don't know life until you get hit, the space shuttle gets hit, or the space station gets hit by a piece of sand going 17,000 miles an hour.
That's the point, that the...
But
grain of sand going 17,000 miles an hour, you know, can... do some damage to a spacecraft because
absolutely, you but I go, I swear, I just watched a movie about the Earth, and he goes,
right.
"Did you? Did you?" I go, "Well, I thought I did. I don't know. I mean, I didn't think about it that much."
Yeah,
it was like,
because for perspective, a pistol bullet is usually subsonic, like 500 miles an hour or something like that. And we know that can do severe damage. So
at 500, exactly.
Yeah. So all you need is a grain of sand and so on. And again, sometimes a large grain of sand burns up in the atmosphere, can be visible because, you know, it gets to tremendous temperatures.
I think a lot of...
tens of thousands of degrees.
I think a lot of, I know for me, it's a fear I always have is a meteor hitting the Earth. Because, you know, I can imagine like that, you know, everything being, you know, from the stories and what we hear, but, you know, the sun being blocked out. You know how long the sun was blocked out when the meteor hit the Earth? 10,000 years. I mean, that's a long time.
I don't think it was blocked out that long, was it? I don't know. I'm not familiar with that, but
I guess,
you know,
the point,
something that size, 10 miles across or whatever it was, would do some, you know, major damage, would wipe out.
Well, and apparently when that hit, and they're finding that there was another asteroid that hit up in Iceland that did some different things, and I don't know enough about it to even talk about it, but the one that hit down towards Mexico, it hit in a spot and in a way that, like, if it had been, you know, all the way out in the ocean, it might not have been as bad. If it had been all the way on the ground, it might not have been as bad. There was, I guess, a lot of sulfur in that area where that meteor hit. The sulfur being brought up into the atmosphere created a different situation. So whatever it was, and it was a long time. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, it hit on Monday and it was cleared up by Sunday. It was a long... The bigger thing to me is that, you know, I've been alive 50 years. But this has been going on, you know, the 4.5 billion, you know, whenever they think that it started. I mean, it's such a small part, especially like with global warming and all this stuff they find in it. It's just interesting.
Yeah, well, NASA does track asteroids and large ones.
Well, and this one guy was saying, you know, they can see, you know, an asteroid. And honestly, if that was what the case was, they wouldn't want to, like, blow it up. They would rather, you know, they would like to mine it. You know, they were talking about, like, they tried to get the minerals from this asteroid before it hit us. But if they, I guess you can, like, turn an asteroid just by heating up side of it, you know, part, just a degree or something.
Again, it depends on how much warning you have. If you
absolutely
have, you know, 10 years warning, you can do a relatively small change in its orbit to prevent it from colliding with the Earth. But, you know, if you've got...
Well, and didn't we just have one that came into the atmosphere just like, what, a few weeks ago? And they didn't really, I think they didn't know.
Yeah, fairly small ones, relatively few make it all the way to the Earth's surface. But the ones, you know, like ones explode at fairly low altitudes can do a lot of damage.
You know? Yeah. Well, that one, and then they were saying that these rocks, you know, and I think, oh, meteor, fine. little chunk of meteor, great. But it's like 4.5 billion years old. I mean, it's like that meteor could have been from when the solar system or it all started. Mm-hmm. That's interesting because it didn't come from here. Are you interested in astronomy and all that stuff?
Somewhat. It's not really my area of expertise, but I have worked on one astronomical satellite a number of years ago that looked at the extreme ultraviolet, which is light that the wavelength's too short. It gets absorbed in the upper atmosphere, so you have to go out in space to look at it. And, again, I don't know too much about the science, but I did work on the instrumentation.
Yeah, and this isn't about knowing about a lot. This is just chatting about fun mm-hmm. stuff and interesting yeah. stuff. When I watched that one, the thing on Netflix, One Strange Rock, the one thing that I was shocked by is how bright the sun is in space. You know, we have this protection. Our atmosphere protects yes. us from the sun. You know, we obviously can still be damaged, but out of that, and it's like the one astronaut's like, you know, I came out of the space shuttle and I looked at the sun and I just didn't realize how powerful and bright, you know, because out there it's just a star.
Right.
You know, here it's a sun. And it's weird how, like, you know, Earth creates, like, you know, whether it's like religion or, you know, spirituality, but out there in space, you're not really associated with the Earth anymore. You're just space. And, you know, I always think is that, you know, is it religion carry into space or those you know, things that were raised? Because out there, we're just space material floating, you know?
Yeah, it's a pretty hostile environment. Like on spacecraft, again, if there's one surface that faces the sun, it can be hot. It can get over the boiling point of water, 212. And then the other side is very cold. And, in fact, we use that to cool detectors and things like that. We take advantage of the fact that things pointing away from...
Is it up to, like, a 600-degree fluctuation in temperature?
I don't think it's quite 600, but it's several hundred.
Yeah, I mean, it's like...
300, 400, yeah, I mean...
But, I mean, the sun's gone, and it's really cold, and the sun comes back, and it's really hot. That's wild.
Yeah.
The stuff, the materials that they build, like even like satellites and the shuttle, you know, you would look at it and you'd say, well, that's tinfoil or that's gold foil. I mean, that would never have serve a purpose here on the planet. But without gravity and all that, you know, like almost in a vacuum, it's unaffected as much as it would be here on the Earth.
Well, that's true. You can use coatings for mirrors on space that would get tarnished on the Earth very fast and stuff like that. But
you're still working, but you're retired and you're here in Rehoboth. How do you like, what brought you here to Rehoboth? What keeps you here? Do you guys do anything fun here? I know you're working, but you got to still find some time for fun.
Yeah.
You're smiling.
Yes.
It's a wonderful place to live.
Do you guys get to enjoy, like, do any of the walking, like go out to Gordon's Pond? If you want to, oh no, you can't do that. You turned it off.
Oh.
Here, turn the microphone back on. You got a switch on the side.
This?
No, it's on the back. No, hold on. I'm gonna have to pause it.
Yeah, I'm back.
Hey, a little technical difficulty. We got to figure it out. So, do you guys get to walk?
Yeah, we like to go out to walk a couple miles every day or so.
This is a great area for that, don't you think?
Yes, we love it because, you know, there's places like Boardwalks at, you know, Rehoboth and Bethany and places like that. There are the trails, some of the trails you have pictures of. We walk on them. We go to Prime Hook sometimes. We go to, Cape Henlopen, and we like to take walks in these different places.
Well, it's cool how they've changed all these rails to trails.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a great idea,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, the paths are already there.
Yes.
And, you know, I forget I think the last governor, Carper, was it? He was big into, you know, the trails. He was really about, you know, putting money into it. And I think it's totally made our area, improved it a ton. I mean,
yeah.
And, you know, they build these trails, and then you see, like, these guys, and sometimes I get annoyed, but you see these older guys in these groups, like, I think they're in the Peloton, in the Tour de France, riding around on these trails, and these groups going 100 miles an hour. You know, good for them. It's great that they're out, but sometimes they, you know, they feels like they own the they think they own the trail, and I get a little frustrated. But, you know, at the same time, it's still getting older folks and younger folks out doing stuff.
Yeah.
And especially now with the as much traffic as we had, you know, it's hard to ride around on the highways.
Right, I know.
In the byways.
And, of course, we do have the beaches.
We got beaches.
We don't swim as much as we used to, but we do.
You'll get in the ocean?
Yeah.
Yeah. I love the ocean. Mm-hmm. It's just the best. It's a mental medication. I like to just get to when my chin's just right in it and then have like a, you know, not a big wave, but just a nice wave that just passes through me.
Right.
I feel like it just washes the energy out of me, the negativity. I was able to run the beach yesterday, and it was just beautiful. Mm-hmm. Just, I forget, we went to Mexico for our honeymoon, and, you know, you go for the beach and the ocean. The beach was kind of crappy. The ocean was nice. It was clean and clear, but we have better beaches than Mexico by far.
Yeah, I know. Delaware really does have nice beaches. Absolutely.
Yeah, the beaches are amazing. Mm-hmm. And so we're blessed. And then, you know, all the fun, other fun stuff that we get to do here. But so you guys get to get out. Have you ever gone surf fishing? Are you a fisherman?
No, I haven't fished since I've been here. I have in the past. Sometimes when the kids were little, we used to go to Chincoteague for vacation and you know, we'd rent a boat and some tackle and go out. I'd take the kids out fishing sometimes. I enjoyed that.
I have so many people that mention Assateague. Oh, we're going down to Assateague. Well, we went to Assateague. I've never been. And it sounds like I need to go check it out because it's a lot of people go there. Is it, what's better over in Assateague, just less people?
Yeah, I'll avoid mosquito season. That's my first advice because they don't spray on Assateague itself. They do spray in Chincoteague. But
Chincoteague—that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, Chincoteague is the place where you actually stay. Assateague is a preserve, so they don't have, you know.
That's where the horses are, right?
That's where the horses are. Yeah, and
I read something. They were spraying for no-see-ums up in the river upstate. It's like,
yeah.
Oh well, that's good. I didn't realize they did that. You know these. I was flying, I did a vlog for a while where I was flying a drone. You can see some of the pictures on the TVs, but one of the things that I noticed when you fly, especially out at Gordon's Pond or just a lot of these, you know, these marsh areas, that there's these trenches out in the marsh, these like canals. And a buddy of mine, Brownie, I was like, what are those for? And he goes, those are for mosquito control. And I was like, I still don't understand why they do it. I guess maybe it has the mosquitoes come out into these openings and then maybe fish can eat them or something. But it was like, you know, 50, 75 years ago, they weren't spraying for mosquitoes everywhere like they do now. No. So they had to try to figure out different ways of handling that problem. But
I'm not familiar with that. No.
Well, you would know if you were getting bit up by mosquitoes 50
yes.
years ago compared to how it is today.
Right, yes, it was.
They take care of us a little better. But I always laugh at these, you know, like an HDTV or something, these shows where lately they've had these like beach hunters or beach house hunter shows where they show them three houses and they end up in this, you know, they want to be by the ocean. And, it's always great, but a lot of flies and a lot of critters come by right. the ocean. And
yeah, that's true.
I had a person I used to know owns a house that's over, you know, on the beach. And I remember we would run from the house to the boat because you could literally get eaten by all the flies on your way out to the boat.
Yeah.
There was no outdoor activity in the summer there.
Right. Well, certainly Chincoteague at night is the mosquitoes rule. And we're
flies.
Yeah.
Biting flies.
And they had the green-headed fly, too. That's another thing that... That actually takes a bite out of your flesh.
I'm familiar with that fly. I'm familiar with all critters here in Delaware.
Yeah.
Well, and if you go down to, you know, the state park and you go lay out on the beach, the black flies bite.
Mm-hmm.
But if, like, there's a, I think I just saw there's maybe one in this room. There, you know, black flies here don't bite. So I don't understand. Is a the biting black fly, is that an immature green fly? I mean, why?
I don't know.
Why is that going on, Jim? That's why I had to bring you on the podcast for some fly information.
Well, outside of my area of expertise, all I know is I don't like green-headed flies and mosquitoes and no-see-ems and other...
So how did you get into your expertise? What pulled you... What was your... Like, as a kid, were you just fascinated by something and that's what...
Well, I'm... I grew up in the post-Sputnik era where people were encouraged to go into physical sciences. And then, you know, I decided to major in physics.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to University of Delaware undergrad in Pennsylvania, U of Pennsylvania, for my master's and PhD. And I actually worked in a different field. I was working in magnetic resonance, but... At that time, it was kind of an esoteric field. Now, you know, that we have the MRIs in medicine, and it's, you know, got a lot of practical applications. But I wound up working, coming down here and starting working with satellites. And I became a support contractor to Goddard Space Flight Center. I also did some DOD work during the Department of Defense work during the Cold War.
I have an
working on ways of trying to keep a plane or a helicopter from getting shot down. And a lot of the technology is very similar. But, you know, for the past, I guess, 30 years or so, I've been working almost exclusively with satellites, with NASA and NOAA.
My dad was a retired colonel. My dad was the first person to go to the Air Force Academy in Delaware, class of 59. And he was in charge of like something that was called IFN, Identification, Friend, Foe, or Neutral. And they used to run war games. And, I mean, we always hear the story, the computer was the size of the room. And, you know. It was true. I saw it. It was a huge, giant computer. And now, you know, I probably have more computing power in my watch than I did in that whole room.
Yes.
But, you know, at the time, it was what it was. And I think it's even, I think as for him, it's even mind-blowing to just see that where the technology has gone and to have lived it then and to live it now is just, but he, you know, as he's gotten older, he just has no real fascination with computers. I mean, he's big into computers, but he's not. He's just like, whatever. He doesn't really get too much into it. But so you've been associated with Delaware for a while.
Yeah, I grew up in northern Jersey. I came down to Delaware, and while I was at Penn, after I got married, Mary taught in northern Delaware, and so I commuted on the train up to Philadelphia. And
So when's the first time you came to Rehoboth Beach?
Actually, when I was an undergraduate, back, you know, over 50 years ago, I came a couple times.
You weren't blown away by Rehoboth Beach back then? I'm sure it was much different.
Probably.
What was it like back then?
Well, it was, a lot was the same, but, you know, the Kagan Cork, I had friends who were musicians who were playing back then.
Bottle and Cork?
Bottle and Cork, yeah.
Keg and Cork, that's a good name.
Bottle and Cork, yeah. And so I came down then, and another time I came down, the mother of a friend of ours had a place here, and so several of us came down to...
So back then, like 50, 60, 70 years ago, and I know you weren't, you know, that doesn't include you, but you know, I get this feeling like Milford was like the big city, you know, the big town. Milford, Georgetown, and then you know what? Like nobody lived at the beach. We just maybe came here for the summer. We hung out down here, but after you know, summer was over, everyone left. Either moved back up to Milford or Dover, but it didn't seem like back then Rehoboth was a big year-round place to live.
I don't really know. I just came down here in the summer, so. I don't know what it was like in the winter.
Exactly. Yeah, because nobody was here in the winter. Nobody knew what it was like in the winter. They just knew it was here in the summer. And I'm sure people lived here year-round.
Yeah, but But I know at that time Sussex County was overwhelmingly agricultural, and then I think the tourism trade just has grown a lot in the last
do you know
50
what,
years.
What was the big thing grown back then? Same thing, soybeans and corn? Or
yeah, people raised chickens, and I guess they could grow soybeans and corn to feed them and so on. And
yeah, well, that's true.
I mean, it's Sussex. Southern Delaware has always been known for poultry, I gather.
Yeah, well,
pig farming also.
My dad would tell me that back in when he was a kid, they would catch crabs out in the canal, mm-hmm. and he said you couldn't give them away. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody liked crab back then. He said it was just mm-hmm. a nuisance. But now yeah. they're like, and the same thing. I've heard the same story about lobsters. People like lobster was used to feed the poor, and
yeah, I know. Back in colonial times, I've heard it was used to feed prisoners and stuff like that, and the poor. And people complained about it. Now it's of course, delicacy.
I'm not a big fan of lobster. I'll eat some crab. I don't go crazy over crab. I don't drink. I think you need beer for both. But I don't, you know. So what's on the? I mean, so is this project this satellite? Is it going to be completed? I mean,
Well, right now we're kind of on hold. We basically confirmed that the way they track the satellite at night was valid, so that they know where they're looking
mm-hmm.
with this particular instrument, the geostationary lightning mapper, so they can see a lightning flash and then say this is the place on the ground it came from. And to do that, we use the two lasers far apart, so we, you know.
Do you think we'll ever get to a point where we can predict where lightning's going to strike? I mean, is that what you're trying to figure out, or are you just mapping lightning?
Basically, they're mapping lightning for warnings. Now, they're correlating it with data from the main instrument, the so-called Advanced Baseline Imager. And so there's certainly things where there's a lot of cold air up high and then warm, moist air that rises. Cold air falls, they meet and they get lightning, they get, you know, precipitation.
Yeah, no, I mean.
Because of the, so they can, people are trying to push back the threshold of how long you can, ahead of time, can you predict severe weather. And I think they're doing that, but this has been a big part of the system. Again, there are low-orbiting satellites, too, that give more detailed information, but not on a continuous basis. They, you know.
No,
you know, the combination together with that and the Doppler radar, these are all big helps.
You would think with all the information that we have and the technology that, like, nobody should die anymore. But it's still, that's the unfortunate part of weather is, like, can tell you when it's going to be severe and you should go inside, but there's always the people that got to go out and look.
Right. Yeah, well, weather's pretty chaotic system. I don't think people can predict, you know, they're trying to push back the threshold, but
Well, I'm a big fan of, I love, like I maybe mentioned in the beginning, I love clouds. And I do a lot of time-lapse photography on clouds. And I love, and we don't see it a lot. But, you know, you watch the weather at night or the news and they'll show, the pattern of how the, you know, it's working.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to think that weather moves that fast. It's very slow.
Yeah.
And I love when they show like a time-lapse or whether it's time-lapse or just the continuous video feed of weather. You know, as these, you know, as it works across the United States and then ended into Europe and different places, but there's a lot more to weather than just this, you know, these clouds that fly over every, you know, 15 mm-hmm. minutes. There's a lot to it, and when you watch it, you start to understand, you know, how weather works. I wish they showed that more.
Yeah, well, one thing about the lightning mapper is that there's a lot of cloud to cloud lightning, much more than cloud to ground. And that's not always visible from the ground. You can't.
That's more like a heat lightning or something more.
Well, it's just that different clouds get different electrical charges.
Mm-hmm.
This, friction creates, just like a Van de Graaff generator, for example,
right.
If you're familiar with that, creates charge, and different clouds charge at different rates. So you get.
Is that the thing that, like, discharge. The sandpaper slides over the brushes and
yeah.
just, and then.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of phenomenon occurs in weather.
Weather's amazing. I love doing the time lapse. I look up and I say, today is a beautiful cloud day.
Mm-hmm.
But I look up and you look up and say, oh, that's pretty. But put a time lapse camera on it and watch it over mm-hmm. 45 or an hour, and you're like, wow, that's amazing. And you start to see all the different layers and levels of activity. You know, there's like a low cloud layer mm-hmm. that's going one way, and then this big cloud layer that's going another.
Mm-hmm.
I was telling somebody, I go, you know, it's never winding, it's never blowing, it's always sucking. You know, it's not like we have a fan blowing wind. We have a low pressure system pulling it. It's a sucking, but, you know.
Well, that's true, yeah.
But that always, people are like, well, I don't get that. It's not blowing, it's sucking. There's no fan.
Well, it's a it's difference in pressure, so wind goes from high pressure to low pressure, yeah.
What's your favorite season this time of year, or this, in Rehoboth? We're getting ready to go, obviously, into the one that we mostly think is nice, but do you enjoy winter? Do you like fall, spring?
I like fall and spring pretty well. Once we get into summer, we get extreme congestion. Now, we moved from suburban Maryland right outside the Beltway, so it was all year long. It was like Rehoboth is on the 4th of July, that the traffic jam.
So you laugh a little under your breath when people say we have bad traffic.
Yeah, it's getting there.
It's really from like Home Depot to McDonald's.
That's true.
Maybe to the Starbucks. That's mm-hmm. about it. That's our traffic problem.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you say? It's not.
It's not as bad as it is on the Beltway, and Virginia was even worse than Maryland. And
I can think of the 22 years that I've lived here, the longest I've ever sat in traffic, and that would maybe be coming from my shop to my house, which is over by a kid's cottage. I think maybe, and there was one day there was an accident in front of Wawa. It literally took me 1 hour to get home. And I think half of that problem was I sat over on Plantation Road going the back way in this giant traffic jam when I think the accident had already been cleared up. And you just don't want to, try and work your way down there until you know for sure. But I always say, the traffic is bad. Sometimes summer can be just as bad as like a February snowy day.
Mm-hmm.
You might get out once, take care of what you got to get out, but once you get back, you're going to stay home for the rest of the day, and you're probably going to stay inside because it's so damn hot.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the ups and downs of Rehoboth. How long have you been here?
We came in 2013.
Oh, not that long, but you've been visiting.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right, yeah, I guess so.
Well, if you came down when you were in college, that was not 2013.
That was not. We moved here. We became Delaware residents in 2013. We were actually Delaware residents from the time we got married in 1969 to 74 when we lived on the northeast side of Wilmington, just near the city line. And
so you've seen some. I visited this when I was 15, so 35 years ago, and there's been a lot of changes even since mm-hmm. then. I remember coming down here, and Lowe's was where Home Goods is now. There's been a lot of changes. So, well, listen, I invited you to do something that probably you thought you may never be doing, which is a podcast. It seems to be like the new thing, the new deal. And I know that I don't know if you were worried about it, but I know that you were, thinking about it. And I appreciate you coming on because
okay,
I know
sure.
this is out of your norm. And you know, the podcast is just about chatting with local people doing local things, and I'm fascinated by anybody that's like a physicist. I just think that that's just another level of brain power that I never got dished out to me. So I'm always interested in speaking with people about that, and I appreciate you taking your time on this Wednesday. Thank on this beautiful day, you could be out walking the trails, but you chose to come over here and chat with me, so thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for
and thank you for everything you're doing. You know, the work you're doing on these satellites to try to help us with our weather and understanding it, I appreciate it. You know, that is a service that we need to also thank people for doing as well. Police and satellites.
Yeah.
So, Jim, thank you. Mary, thank you so much. We talked for 1 hour. I hope that didn't hurt or wasn't too painful. And I hope, you know, you'll still have a great day afterwards.
Right. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, guys. Bye.
Okay. Bye.